You're listening to the Thank God for Nostra podcast.
All right, welcome to another episode of the Thank God for Nostra podcast. Today I have with me Tim Bauma. Did I say that right? Did I get that?
Yeah, it's Bauma, Bauma, Bauma. It just depends where you are. Go for all the different pronunciations.
Cool. Sure. Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on the podcast. I'm excited to chat with another developer. I have not had a lot of interactions with you, but it looks like you're working on some interesting things. But before we jump into that, I was wondering if you could give a quick introduction of yourself to the audience, kind of what your background is, what got you into Nostra, all that kind of stuff.
Sure. So my name's Tim Bauma. My handle on Nostra, Twitter, the likes is TR Bauma. I'm quite active on Nostra. You'll see me posting quite a bit on my project Safebox, which we're going to be talking about, but I do a lot of like other philosophical postings and industry postings as well. So my background, I'm an engineer by training. I was in the software development industry as your early part of my career, kind of gradually shifted over to like product management and marketing. And then, you know, did the management consulting thing, and then ended up working as like a policy analyst decided after a while doing all that highfalutin stuff, decided to move back towards my roots as an engineer. I wouldn't say my career was a software engineer the whole time. I still consider myself pretty antiquated in my skills, but started to realize about maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I needed to get back to my roots and started to pick up development again and kind of landed on Python. And that gave me the best bang for my buck. And I got into Bitcoin probably about 2015 when I first heard of it, and then devoured like Anton Antonopoulos's book and then Jimmy Song's book, and went through the Lightning book as well, and went down rabbit holes of understanding cryptography from first principles, totally fascinated by that. And, you know, I'd say about 4 years ago, that's when I started to brush up on my programming skills again and started to work on a few projects. And then, you know, I got into Lightning about 3-4 years ago and then started to play around with the LUDs with the Lightning, I forget what the acronym is for, but I played around with the authentication and I played around with the Lightning addresses and got that working. And then I became aware of like Cashew, the project that came about back in about late 2022, I think it was. Fell head over heels in love with Cashew and started to work on a project of basically integrating that with Lightning. And then got into Nostra a couple of years ago too, fell head over heels in love with Nostra. And now I'm just trying to combine all that stuff. And here I am today.
Nice. That's awesome. So yeah, you were pretty early into Bitcoin. And you're coming at Nostra from a Bitcoin perspective, which is obviously a pretty common route. A lot of the things you said, you know, I messed around with Lightning 4 years ago, 3 years ago as well. Tried to run a node, couldn't make it profitable, all that kind of thing. It's a pretty common story. What was it about Nostra that interested you and kind of made you move from Lightning or at least integrate Lightning into the Nostra ecosystem?
Yeah, it was a combination of things. Like, I do have quite a bit of familiarity with like digital credentials and digital identity and the technologies associated with that. And, you know, reasonably familiar with the various protocols that are out there. And just found it like super, super complex and really hard to implement. And you always seem to have to deal with standards bodies and get permission to do anything. And you had to deal with proprietary interfaces and that and so on and so forth. And I guess I fell into Nostra when, you know, when Jack Dorsey started to talk about there was a big buzz. That was probably late 2022 or so. But I remember reading like NIP 1 and I went, holy crap, this protocol is organized from completely different, it's from a completely different starting point. This idea of signed events, and you had the cryptography baked right into the core of the protocol. And, you know, I started playing around with it, with my Cashew and Lightning project. I just remember when the NIP 57 came out, the Zaps, and I got that working, and it was like great to see, like, from my application that I built where I would do a Zap and actually see it appear. It was pretty cool. But then, you know, I started to appreciate the protocol more and more, and I realized, wow, you can do everything with this. You can communicate, you can sign up, you could issue credentials, you can publish notes, you can publish long form, you can actually, you know, publish information about yourself, like in a kind zero event, you can map it to like a domain name. And the more and more I looked at it, I went, wow, this is, you know, it's simple. And all of the stuff I'm seeing in like the quote unquote mainstream world where they kind of twist themselves around proprietary interfaces and that, it's like, oh, you can do this really easily in Noster. And the more and more I started to look at it, I said, well, this is really straightforward. Like once you understand the cryptography and the events and how every event has its own identity, how addresses are automatically derived, you go, wow, this solves a lot of problems. So I just feel like I'm getting more and more excited about Noster like every day. And I'm just seeing like the feeling that I get having experience with Twitter. I did a few things with Blue Sky as well, is that I feel like I'm on somebody else's property, like in a mall, asking their permission to do things. And Noster, I just feel like I'm on the outside, New Frontier. I don't have to ask anybody's permission to do anything. I just do it. And it's just that freedom of development. And that was very, very attractive to me. And it continues to be very attractive to me. And so that's not learning. Like I'm 100% in, 110% in.
Yeah, all it takes on Noster to get into the inner circle is to just like make up some kinds and then start publishing them and get people to use your stuff. And there it is. Like you just made up a core part of the protocol. Your point about the cryptography being baked in is kind of interesting. As I look at more and more other protocols, some of them have the cryptography baked in, but a lot of them treat the Cypher suite as this optional add-on. And like MLS, for example, has a default Cypher suite, but Jeff G is trying to make the SCCP 25519 keys work with that. That kind of mentality of keeping everything loosely decoupled has a large amount of cost. It's the same thing as like, you know, doing everything from an object-oriented point of view where everything is decoupled, when really you're just making an application. You don't need to have factory functions if you're only ever going to make one instance of your database connection or whatever it might be. And like Noster takes that really left curve approach to the problem of making a protocol, bakes a whole bunch of assumptions in, and then says, here you go, deal with it. The protocol is what it is. There's not a lot of like flexibility that you can do to swap out core components of it, but that means that you have a solid foundation that you can build everything else on top of. Do you agree with that assessment? Or
yeah, absolutely. Like you read NIP 1 and everything's pretty much from first principles. And like, you know, the NIP is only about 3-4 pages long, if that. And like I've gone through it very, very carefully. And it's like, oh, I understand everything here. I understand, while it might not have everything to begin with, how you can actually build on it, some very simple building blocks. And I don't feel like I'm implementing somebody else's wish list. I can do everything from square zero. Like, again, when I got deep into cryptography, it was actually Jimmy Song's book, the Programming Python, or Programming Bitcoin, and all the examples were in Python. And I coded everything, all the cryptography, all by hand, just so I understood it. And it's like, oh, and that's like, again, me being an engineer, like the approach that I like to take is that you need to understand stuff from first principles. You have to hand code or hand do something once, or like to build it by hand once. But then once you got that in your mind, then you can actually start designing and building stuff because you know what the limitations are. You know the properties of the material that you're dealing with. So that's the approach I took. And I did the same thing with Noster as well. Like I found an example that's basically built like a Noster client from scratch. Like it was only like a a couple hundred lines of code, but it was all just with the basic primitives, with the basic libraries. And I go, wow, I understand all this stuff. And most importantly, I don't have to rely on anybody else. Like the only thing I really need to rely on are a few libraries, like the libsec library. Like I'm not going to implement that myself. Just use that, the WebSocket stuff. And the protocol itself, like, is just so elegantly simple. And then you just realize that there's a huge potential. It'll take a long time, but I don't want to give away my age or my vintage, but I just remember in the early days of the internet how excited I was to do like ping, www.google.ca or ping any IP address, and I could get like a return. And that just completely captivated me. And I just feel like it's the same thing with Noster now. And with the work I'm doing, like where I see Noster is really coming into its own, is that the tight integration with the payments, or being able to transfer value to any address out there, whether it be an event or someone's public key. That's a simple and really powerful notion. And I'm just like totally captivated with that potential. How it's going to work out in the future, I don't know. But I just see now we have this, it's not a security overlay. It's basically, the way I'm trying to describe it, it's almost like a socioeconomic overlay over the internet and transport. And like if you wanted to, you could actually not have the internet. You could put another like a transport layer underneath, but you now have the way to uniformly address anything, an event or a public key, and you can send value to it. And it's like, wow, that's really, really exciting.
Yeah, that first principles approach is really interesting because, I feel like I've heard from some developers coming into Noster development and they say, where do I start? Everything is so complicated. And I don't know if those developers have started by reading the NIPS and implementing things from first principles, or whether they have started with a library or something like NDK, but libraries have so much complexity in them in order to, optimize for things that they have skewered the simplicity of the protocol that is sitting underneath. To build a high functioning client, yeah, you need to deal with that complexity, but the basics are all there. That might be something worth doing to anyone listening to this who's having a hard time getting started. Like, just try implementing the protocol from scratch in your preferred programming language. Take a couple hours, a couple days to get familiar with it, and then move up to a library to take care of the complexity. But yeah, like you're saying, like starting from something that is fundamentals and getting that mental model in your head can help a ton. Because Noster is not that complicated in terms of looking at the WebSocket and messages and stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I'll give credit where credit is due. One of the libraries that I'm using is called Monster. You just Google it, you'll find it. And it has all the functionality that I've needed so far. And I can go down the code and I can understand it. And I'm building my project based on the Monster library, which in turn is on Noster. And of course, the Cashew project as well. So, yeah, like, some of the frameworks I find, if you depend too much on a framework, it's a give and take. If a framework oftentimes takes away your flexibility, they become very opinionated. This is a way to do things. And then it takes away your flexibility, or you actually have to cut through the complexity of the framework to really understand what you're looking for. And yeah, you might get something for free, but sometimes it's at the cost of flexibility. And so it's just a trade-off.
Yeah, totally. So let's get into your project, SafeBox, a little bit. What is it, and what it motivated you to create it?
Yeah, okay. I'll give you a bit of history. Another thing that people might not know, that I was part of the Sovereign Engineering Cohort, number two. So I was in Madeira from May and June, and I was invited because of my project at the time, which I was calling it Nemo Cash, which basically a lightning payment system where it's custodial, of course, it's web-based, but I took a different approach in what I built. Instead of having like a database to store account information, what I did, I, I, hacked out the wallet from the Cashew project and put it in the back end of my system. So when a Lightning payment came in, I didn't update a database per se. Well, I used the database, but I actually converted everything to Charmian tokens or proofs. Well, actually, yeah, proofs, and then actually stored that in the wallet. And then when a Lightning payment, the wallet needed to make a Lightning payment, I would just like pull out the proofs that I needed. I would send it off to the mint and make it look like a regular boring Lightning wallet. And then what I did when I was in Madeira, I took my wallet and literally field tested it. Like, I would go to the cafe every day. I would go to restaurants and fine tuned it. So literally, I was paying for everything in Madeira with my wallet. The other thing I added too was presenting everything in the local currency. So I added at the edge, I added the ability that while everything was stored in like Bitcoin or Satoshis, denominated Satoshis, I just added a conversion capability. So if you wanted your stuff presented in euros, okay, there we go. You want to pay in euros, you know, you just pull out euros and present euros. And so made it just look like an ordinary like payment app. And so I was really happy how that project evolved and had something like, look, you know, it's not very sexy looking, but I got it to the point that if I needed to get a UX designer or someone to clean it up, you know, I was at that position. I was more concerned with developing the back end capability. But there was one part that was bothering me, was that I still had like a back end database and storing the proofs and everything, and it was like a single point of failure. So I had some interest. I do have some potential partners that are really keen on deploying this as a solution in a country, for example. And I'm going, oh, I don't know. Like if I get tapped on the shoulder, you know, I have to turn everything over, and it's like too bad, so sad. So that really, really, really bothered me. And so I just did. I proved to myself I actually could build a damn thing. I proved that I could reverse engineer everything that I needed to actually integrate into my system. But this part was really bothering me, was that at the end of the day, it's still a custodial solution. And it's like, okay, you know, I realized that if this was going to be deployed as like a real application or a real service, there would be a lot of like DevOps and security stuff and that. And it would just take a lot to get up and running. And then, you know, I got to know when I was in Madeira, I got to know Pablo very well, and Gigi, and there's a few other folks. We'd debate this stuff in and out. Like, you know, we'd have these really heavy debates about what to do and that. And then I was tracking very closely. And then I saw what Pablo was doing with NIP60, which was creating the, I forget what it's called, the Nuts wallet, or putting
nut zaps and
nut zaps and cashew nuts. And I looked at NIP60 and I went, holy shit, I can take that idea, and instead of storing the data in a database, I could actually store the data as replaceable events in a relay. And I went, wow. And the other thing I realized too was that, okay, if I encrypt all this stuff, no one can crack it unless they get the private key. And so, like, I took the core idea for what Pablo had done, but I made some variations. There was a few variations. One, what I did, instead of using my own NSEC, I actually generate an NSEC for the component itself. So when you fire up a new wallet, it randomly generates an NSEC. I store it locally or whatever. But everything is stored in a relay that is specified. The other thing I wasn't very comfortable with was, like, you know, the tags and all the information were stored in the clear, and the D tags and whatever. It's like, oh, I don't like that. If I wanted to create a system that would just work in a totally completely adversarial environment. So I said, oh boy, what am I going to do here? So I made some changes where I basically hash the tags I figure, what do I do? I take the private key, and then I append that to like the label that I want to hash in the event, or descriptor label, put it through a hashing algorithm, get basically a 256 random number that looks completely random. And then the other part, I was using NIP4 for doing the encryption, but did the heavy lifting to get up to NIP17 or NIP44, got all that working. So now I created this like little record management in my wallet that basically, you know, when I store stuff, I come up with a completely random looking D tag and then encrypt everything. And then when I pull it back in, I know the names that I stored things at, and then I just do the reverse hash and kind of figure that out and then just map that all back. So I created this little records management system in my wallet for managing, like, first of all, managing wallet state. Like, I needed to manage not only the proofs, like the funds that you have, I had to manage that. I had to manage some like state. I also took a different approach just to, what I did in my proofs. I was very efficient on my storage, where I had only stored the ID and the actual proof values and the mint and everything. I stored in another file so that I could just look it up. So if I needed to, you know, for this proof, oh, this is a key set. Oh, do I have it? Oh yeah, there we go. That's the URL. And then I would calculate all that. So I did a bunch of stuff like that. So I would say it's not NIP 60 compliant anymore, but that's okay. I'm in the process of writing up a spec for anybody that wants to implement it. So, you know, I was testing it. Like, I found a relay in Beijing of all places, and it's like, okay, I ran payments through that. It worked. Found one in Buenos Aires. It worked. I found one in, like, you know, some island in the Far East. It was a bit slow, but it worked. And so where I got really excited was that now I see the ability or the possibility to create a wallet that everything just exists out in the network. And if you have the private key on one place and a code on another place and the computational resource another place, they're all completely useless by themselves. But if you can bring that together into a component, and then you can actually get the data from the relays and do a payment. So, you know, I'm just refining it. So, like, for me, it's the what Nostr has done, going back to those primitives, it's enabling some architectural innovations that I just never would have dreamed of with the other protocols. So now I see. What I'm really excited about is that now I see the ability to create a wallet that it exists independently of the mobile OS platforms, or exists independently of any machine for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I just implemented, I just got it working last weekend, was just the recovery part, where when I fire up a wallet, I generate a 12-word recovery phrase and I present it. And then I have another function called recover, and I would go to a completely new machine. If I knew the home relay where the data was stored, I would just do safebox recover, and boom, I was in business on a completely different machine. And so, in fact, I was using the same wallet on two different machines. I was depositing money on one machine, my development machine, and then I was actually spending money from a completely different machine out there. It's like, try to trace that. We're not going to trace that.
Have you run into any problems with consistency as far as, you know, stuff getting stranded on relays, and then, you know, when you restore your seed, you don't know which relay to look at? Or would you build the relay into the seed? Or, like, how would you do relay selections and make sure that you're not double spending bearer tokens and stuff like that?
Oh, so what's really cool, the double spending is already taken care of. So let's say you have, if for whatever reason, data doesn't get synchronized. Like, first of all, I've designed it so that in order for you to recover, you need to have what I call a home relay. Like, hey, that's the first relay that you look at. But I've also built the ability to replicate the data to other relays. So, and that's the part I'm still working out. Like, the idea is that the idea is that you find a relay that you work with, the relay operator doesn't know what the heck you're doing, so they can't be implicated, but they might become hostile to you and just say, we're going to shut you down. So then I built a process that basically says, well, let's just replicate all your data over to another relay and then make that your home relay. So you give the idea of the wallet, it can flee like an adversarial relay and just go elsewhere. So like I have the basic functions working, but what was really cool, I was experimenting where I had the data on two completely different relays. So two instances of the wallet using the same private key. And then I would spend funds on one. And I completely independently, and the other instance had no idea that this was going on. But then I have another routine, what I call swap, which will actually validate tokens. So then it would take all the tokens or the proofs, and it would go against the mint. And the mint would say, oh, that's spent, that's spent, that's spent, that's spent. That's okay, that's okay, that's okay. So there's no way to do any double spending because the mint actually enforces that. So that was really cool that like if I had two independent instances running and I spent the proofs on one and the other one tried to use it, like it's not going to work because the main enforcement point is the mint that's out there whose purpose in life is to prevent double spending. So I was like, oh, that's really, really cool. So I don't have to worry about like funds being double spent because the mint takes care of that. And it's like, oh, this is really interesting. By just seeing all these new possibilities of architectural possibilities that I'd never dreamed of being possible before.
Yeah, Cashew is a pretty neat protocol in that way. I was curious about the previous name of the project, Nemo. Was there any particular reason you chose that?
Oh, it was a fun name. So I have like some like fun branding. Like the idea was that So the acronym, it's spelled NIMO.cache. It's still live, but I've actually pointed it to my later name, which is OpenValance.app. But NIMO actually stood for Network Instantiated Monetary Order. I just came, and then I was like, oh, that's cool, Nemo Cache. And then I described it to a few people, and they really loved the name and said, oh, that's really cool. And so I was playing around with that idea that eventually, I don't know if you see, that's kind of the logo that I have for the fish, the clownfish. The idea, or it still is a vision that whatever technology that I built could be implemented as a service. So the idea is that like if someone wants to set up like an operating business called Nemo.cash, well, okay, here we go. And just with the work that I was doing, I realized that there could be many Nemo caches out there, many white labeled, many services that want to white label the product. So I came up with the name Open Balance as the kind of the technology platform. And much to my surprise, openbalance.app was actually available. And someone on my behalf actually snagged openbalance.com. So like I've got the name. So it's like an evolution. Like when I started the project like over 2 years ago, I say almost 3 years ago, I was calling it an OnSats. And people thought that was a little bit too radical or okay. So I kind of, did Nemo Cache sound a bit friendlier, and then now Open Balance thought up. And then Safebox is the vision for that is that's going to be the open source component that anybody can like bolt into the back end of a custodial system. So my goal is to get like the Python implementation stabilized, just kind of nail down all the methods and what it's supposed to do, and then start looking for some other implementations that are closer to the metals, so to speak. One of the fellows I got to know with the Sovereign Engineering cohort is an embedded hardware engineer. So we're already talking about, well, maybe we can create a stripped down version of this that you could actually you know, load up to a very constrained Linux device or even on a chip. And the idea is that just imagine that every device could be economically enabled at the outset. And you have, if it can connect to the internet or connect to Bluetooth or whatever, it can actually instantiate a wallet that just lives out in the network. And it's like, oh, that's a really powerful vision too. And as I said, now we're exploring like different like architectural options that we never dreamed of before.
Nice. That sounds like a really interesting direction to take the project. The reason I was asking about Nemo is I was wondering if it was maybe a reference to the Odyssey, because when Odysseus is with the Cyclops, he calls himself Nemo, which means no one, which is like, it's a perfect name for the project, except that you were saying, you know, that was that version of the project was where you were feeling a little bit of pressure about not being anonymous and being a custodian. So a little ironic, but also fitting from that direction, too. So what's your kind of like end goal with SafeBox? So, you know, if you're looking into embedding this on hardware, is this what kind of use cases is an embedded version of SafeBox going to get an
okay for? So the cool thing is I actually did get an OpenSats grant, a small grant. I'm pretty happy about that. It's going to be announced shortly. Like all the paperwork's done and that. It's going to be in the next blog entry. So I just asked for like, you know, enough funding to help me to get to what I call the out of the proof of concept phase into like a minimal, whatever that's called, a minimal viable product or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
And then that's when I've got everything stabilized, that's when I want to start exploring like different use cases for this. Like I think the one use case will be, and this is what I'm committed to delivering, is take the open source components and say, hey, you want to have a custodial Lightning service, just bolt this in the back end and away you go. I'm also experimenting with creating like a total minimal Lightning address provider service that I'll probably ship as part of the proof of concept. So that the vision there is that if you generate an NPUB and the corresponding NSEC, it should be ready as soon as you generate it. It should be able to receive a Lightning payment. So how do you do that? Well, it can already receive like cashew tokens via NIP 17 by virtue of it communicating to a relay. But I'm also experimenting with creating like a deterministic nickname from the NPUB. And that if you register your NPUB with a Lightning address provider, it can generate your nickname and boom, you have a Lightning address right off the bat. So I'm just looking at like total, like a low barrier to entry, a Lightning address service, a Lightning payment service that anybody could fire up and start receiving funds and sending funds. So that's one side. That's more like an enterprise kind of use case thing. But then I'm also looking at, and again, I'm kind of getting into an area that I'm less familiar with, but creating like a stripped down version that communicates via relays only. It could be like a wallet or a wallet component that could exist on like, let's say a chip for a scooter. Like the idea is I just imagine you could actually create a, you manufacture a scooter and right now they have all these apps that you have to download and whatever. Imagine you have an Austro native scooter where the only thing that you actually have to put into the firmware is just an NSEC. Or maybe even just the NPUB. I'll figure that out. The NSEC in a secure enclave, like put that in and you can just throw the scooter at the door and it just earns money on its own.
Yeah, that's an awesome idea.
Yeah. So experimenting with that.
So one question I have is you keep saying this is a Lightning wallet. I can definitely see how it's an eCash wallet. In what way is it a Lightning wallet? Is it Lightning by way of eCash, or are you implementing Lightning receive using eCash, or are you actually like, you know, opening channels and stuff like that?
Oh, okay.
Or is that like a kind of a goal to bypass the channel management stuff?
So like I'm abstracting it so it all looks the same. But okay. But depending on what payment mechanism you use, you use very different mechanisms. So of course, like let's start at the bottom layer. You have the Bitcoin layer, and then you have the Lightning nodes. And you know how hard it is to manage a Lightning node. It's not trivial. And you open up panels. Like I do have a hosted node. I've got a node that I've had with a Voltage for years. And you know, it takes a lot to manage it. And I have quite a bit of liquidity there. And you know, I manage that and got that up and running. So, you know, I've got the basic infrastructure that I'm using. And then you have the next layer up, and people don't like call it layers, but I do, because you're actually introducing another counterparty. And this is where you're adding in like the Shamian mints, the cashew mints that are communicating to the lightning node to do the invoices, to mint the proofs, etc. And then on top of that, you have the applications that either the wallets or the lightning payment service that I've been building that actually use the wallets, which in turn talk to the mints, which then in turn talk to the lightning nodes, etc. And then SafeBox is kind of at that same level too, where how it actually negotiates all the payments is all basically via the mints. And then the mints in turn like talk to whatever lightning node that it's configured for. And I've made the architecture such that a SafeBox, it can communicate with multiple mints, just whatever mint. Like if a token comes in, it just parses it and says, oh, okay, yeah, I haven't seen this mint before, and here's the keyset ID. I'll stick that in my database so that when I need to redeem that, I know exactly where to look it up and where to send the API calls to. So like SafeBox actually has, you know, how would I describe it? Like the way I'm conceptualizing it, like when I say zaps, you're doing payments and invoking the Nostra network. So when you're doing a zap, either to an event or to a profile, it does all the figuring out to say, okay, this is the event. Who's the author? Let's look up the kind zero. Let's find the LID 16. And then we got that. Then now we have the Lightning address. And then now we can do all the Lightning stuff to do the payment. Or, oh, okay. The other one that I have is that, oh, if you're sending tokens, cashew tokens between two SafeBox instances, it basically says, oh, okay. And I'll issue the token and I'll wrap it up, gift wrap it into NIP-17. And then I'll send it via relay over to the other SafeBox instance, which can be monitoring. And when a message comes in, it just says, hey, is there a cashew token in there? Yep. Okay, I'll take it in. I'll like parse it out. I'll swap it out for a new one, and I'll sort my database. So, you know, what I'm trying to do is make it as simple as possible for the user. Like, I think at the end of the day, the user, or even the user of the component, all they care about is sending Satoshis from point A to point B. Just like, as I said, in the early days of the internet, it was just like about pinging an address. And it's kind of like, that's the vision I see, is I just want to zap an amount to someone. And whether it's via like NIP-17 or through Nostra LID-16 or actually directly via Lightning, doesn't really matter. And so I'm just invoking whatever the most appropriate mechanism is.
I see. Yeah. So when you send a Lightning payment, which Lightning, which Lightning node is sending that? Is that sent via one of the mints, or do you have to have kind of your own? Okay.
Yeah. So the idea is, so let's say I'm going to send you a Lightning payment, and I'm going to send you 21 sats. So I have your Lightning address, and so I type that in. I type in SafeBox pay 21 to John, whatever your Lightning address is, and says, "Oh, okay. Let's just check what's your balance. Okay, you got more than 21 sats. Okay, that's great. So the next thing we got to do is check to see. Let's get the proofs. And oh, by the way, you have these proofs with this mint. So we'll ask the before we do that, we actually ask the Lightning address, saying, hey, Lightning address, I need an invoice for 21 sats. So I go to the Lightning address. I resolve that and get that and get the invoice. And then I then go to the Mint and say, okay, 21 sats. I need the proofs. I'll take it out of my wallet. I'll assemble the proofs. And here's the Lightning address to pay to. Hand that off to the Mint. The Mint does its thing and pays the Lightning invoice on my behalf, which actually was generated from the Lightning address. So there's a lot of like handoffs and stuff that's going on. But at the end of the day, it's actually pretty simple. Like if you do perfectly private payments with cashew tokens, you're just sending a cashew token across the wire or via relay. The accepting safe box just grabs it. And then it just swaps it out at the Mint where it came from, so it can't be double spent, and then puts it into its wallet. If it's a Lightning address, then it just goes through that process that I described, and then you just kind of let the network kind of take care of that. And yeah, it's pretty straightforward.
Gotcha. So the main difference between SafeBox and NIP60 is going to be basically Lightning payment support then, because I think NIP60 is just the eCash part. Is that right?
Yeah, I have to take a close look at it again, because what I had done with my Nemo Cash and my Open Balance, I have a pretty intense Lightning integration. Like I was using eCash more as the way to manage the wallet and the funds, and I could issue cash and accept eCash, but I was kind of viewing it just as another transport to get thats from point A to point B. And I kind of carried that same philosophy over to a SafeBox. So I have a lot of heavy duty integration. I think with NIP60, I have to take a closer look at it. I think it's just eCash only. But like I'm, as I said, I just view it as one of the mechanisms that can be used.
Cool. So you were talking about moving this to kind of more bare metal applications through some other lower level programming language. Is this something that you would see, expect support for in applications, or is this kind of more of a low level nuts and bolts sort of thing?
Well, kind of the simple vision that I have is I want to turn every machine into an economic machine. You have the ability to send and receive payments. So where I'm experimenting with that, like I've taken my Python stuff, I've successfully compiled it into binaries for like the Mac. I think that's, you know, the ARM architecture, and I've also compiled it for the AMD architecture. So I've got binaries, and you can basically pop that onto any Linux system, and boom, you've got a SafeBox. You can actually send and receive funds once you put that binary in your user bin file. And the key thing is that if you have multiple accounts on a Unix box, I basically store stuff in a home directory. So every account all of a sudden is automatically enabled for send and receive payments. So you think about it, just imagine that capability. You can turn any machine into like it can send and receive money, just like it could ping any machine in the world. Like it's like, okay, that's a pretty powerful vision. And then now, what I want to do once I stabilize that, like why can't like a little router have that same capability too? It's just a Unix box, another Unix distribution underneath, or like a simple ESP32 device, or even I know like one individual is really interested in what I'm doing. He actually wants to create a digital wallet that's in the form factor of a credit card. Maybe it's a credit card where it's not even a phone. It just has enough power to negotiate some sort of communication channel, other low energy Bluetooth or whatever. But so I'm kind of looking for those use cases as well. And again, I'm not an expert in this area, but I know that I know it can be done. So I'm really keen to work with someone on that.
Yeah, the possible use cases for NFC are tantalizing. So far, they haven't materialized very much, but it'd be awesome to have an inert wallet. Could this be used for monetizing relays potentially?
Yeah, possibly. I guess where my thinking is that I'm really fascinated with relays because I see them evolving to serve different niches. And I see that there's going to be a real opportunity for someone that understands that a relay could be like an enterprise relay service. And I'm even starting to think about, well, maybe my system actually needs some sort of specialized relay, and maybe payment could be part of that as well. And where my thinking is that, and I have to look into this a little bit more, is that I would need to have some more availability assurance that, hey, these records are available. Like I'm storing, like the funds are stored as I think 37, I forget the number now, a kind 37,000 event or something like that, which are basically addressable events. And then maybe if this goes to an enterprise scale, someone will have to start thinking about building a specialized relay to handle safe boxes. I've played around with, like I have it working with StirFry. I have an instance of StirFry running. It works like a charm, no problems at all. I also had I've been playing around with Alex Gleason's Ditto. It has a built-in relay, works fine. I tried it with there was another I found another Python implementation of a relay, and it worked fine. So it's like, oh, okay, this is really cool. And so I'm only now starting to think of, you know, what the opportunities might be. I don't think the opportunity will be to be in the form of paid relays. I think where the opportunity will be is creating a very specialized service that uses the relay that provides value. So again, I just feel like it's a completely new frontier. What excites me about relays is that I hear everybody talk about data portability, data sovereignty, you know, consent and everything like that. And then they're trying to like say, well, you know, the data, you know, the big platforms, they basically have your data in the clear and, you know, protect it hopefully, but with some, you're at their mercy. And it's like, I see the relays now is that, well, you have no idea what you're storing on. You have no idea what you're storing from me, because I am the sole controller of that private key and I'm encrypting it. You have no idea. You can infer that it might be me, but it's my wallet. That's why I decided to have a private key for the wallet. I didn't want to link it to the identities. So you could instantiate a completely random wallet with a random key and transport stuff over there. Just no way to trace. The other use case that I see is really compelling, and I want to talk to Vitor a little bit more about this, is actually storing health data, like my immunization records and everything like that, and putting them encrypted on a relay. And if I lose my phone or my device or whatever, like especially in other countries where physical security is not a given, if I have those 24 words and I know the home relay, then boom, I can be back in business like in a matter of seconds. So I'm thinking about those use cases where a user has absolutely no physical security. They get their phone taken away, they get their device taken away, it gets wiped out. And so long as they remember those 12 words, they're back in business. And that's kind of what I'm looking at. I'm also looking at, you know, if people say, oh, post-quantum, quantum computers, you know, like that as a credible threat's quite a ways away. I don't think you don't have to worry about that, about signatures or whatever. But if you've got data that potentially is like stored now and harvested later, it could be a possibility. So I'm starting to think about how post-quantum cryptography might be integrated into the Nostra protocol. You know, I live in Ottawa. I walk down the street and I meet like two post-quantum cryptographers. So they're like, this is a pretty dense city in terms of cryptography. I know quite a few people in this space. So I'm just starting to have that conversation that how might we integrate post-quantum cryptography into the Nostra protocol. I view that's not a safe box problem. That's more of a generalized problem. And not, I'm looking at it. I think it'd be pretty easy to do, actually, but I'm just starting to see if there's any viable algorithms or practical algorithms that I can play around with on Python, for example. So,
yeah, there'd be some really interesting research to see for sure. The idea of sharing keys is also kind of interesting. You know, I built my private groups implementation at the beginning of this year and a little bit of last year using a key sharing event. And it didn't work super well because, you know, the gift wraps have to be sent to each individual person. So those key shares would often get rejected by relays because I wasn't selecting relays properly. So like the implementation details were kind of destroyed the whole project. And I've since moved on to relay based groups. It's not that the key sharing stuff doesn't make sense, but I just wasn't quite there. Have you thought about, you know, NIP17 versus MLS at all, or other use cases for key sharing? Because you're nice to be able to share a key and then revoke that share so that you're separating your identities more completely.
Yeah. As I said at the outset, I'm an engineer, not a scientist. So it's just give me the stuff and I'll let you know if I crash with it or not. So I'm looking at it from that. Like I'm following the MLS stuff. I would say I understand it in broad terms and really, I was thinking about like one of the key concepts is the ratcheting aspect. Would I need to actually implement that? But then, you know, the approach I'm taking is that 100% of my security is vested in that generation of that private key, which is used. And if that private key gets compromised, however, I think the way that I'm going to approach it, I did this with another prototype. I'll just create a routine called wallet burn with new key. Basically, just burn everything down, get rid of it, and move everything over under new key. Here's the new key. You figure out how to save it. I'm also looking at, you know, obviously the key, the private key is not safe on your machine. Is, you know, practical purposes, it's fine, but to see if there's a way that I actually be put on some sort of hardware security module. And then, or another thing I've been looking at, like the, I forget the number, the NIP signing stuff is, the signing, I forget which NIP that is.
Take word walk, yes, maybe.
Yeah.
NIP, we had signer stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. 46 or 47 and see if there's a way that I can actually do that. But, that's kind of beyond my abilities. Like I figure the operating assumption that I'm working with is that my security and sovereignty is 100% invested in that self-generated key. And then kind of work with others to figure out, well, maybe there's a more secure way to generate that key and more secure ways to store that key. But I figure like my use case, it's really right now is for someone that has a wallet that might have like $100 or $200 and they're going to use it. You know, it's kind of like you're like my vision is that, you know, when you're traveling, you know, and you're in a hotel and you put your stuff in the safe box, like you have a key or a combo and that's good enough for peace of mind. That's kind of the use case I'm aiming for right now. But then like, if I want to get into the safe deposit box business with the stuff holding hundreds of millions of dollars, well, you know, we'll cross that bridge when we get there.
Yeah, totally different risk profile.
Yeah.
The 4-digit PIN is always laughable. You know, I've got one of those key safes on the back of my house for our house key, and it's a 4-digit PIN, but it has redundant numbers in it. And all you have to do is hit two of the numbers and it opens. So it's a 2-digit PIN. absurdly simple. And of course, there's no like auto lockout after a certain number of brute force attempts. So You could brute force that in, 5 minutes.
Yes.
And, but yeah, for $100, not a big deal. Yeah, there are a couple of hardware signer projects out there. I hadn't followed them closely, but there's like Horse.js or the Horse extension that Fiat Jaff made a few years ago.
Okay.
And Ellen Bits, I know, has some stuff related to that. So Yeah.
I've played around with like the FIDO stuff, the CTAP. That's really hard though. It's really hard to understand. I kind of got it working with the FIDO key and that, and just kind of gave up. It was really complicated. So, but I obviously see the value. Like the vision that I have is, like I had my wallet ripped off when I was traveling in Europe years ago. And I tell you, you have that event and you got to call home and get your parents to cancel all the credit cards, and you're like, this is before the internet, and you had to schedule a long distance call to get home. And, you know, it's like that stuck with me forever. And kind of, what I want to do is to create a wallet that if you lose absolutely everything, you can restore yourself with just either maybe a little hardware key that you have on your person, or you just memorize the recovery phrase. You could walk up to any computer and just get back in business. And that's kind of the vision that I have. And then we'll just figure out how to put on all that extra security later.
Yeah. Have you looked into like Frost signatures or multisig or anything like that?
No, I do have a passing familiarity with that. I don't think I have a need for that yet. I can see there's some neat routines that I could probably put in where you take the recovery phrase and you split it up into three or whatever, and you redact the keywords so that you have to get two of three to come together or something like that. There's a really good site by his name, Ian Coleman's got some really funky, algorithms to do that. So I might do something like that. The multi-signature stuff, it's pretty complicated. And I'm not so sure how that would apply in my context. Eventually it might, but again, I'm just being very pragmatic in what I'm building here. What excites me most is that I can create a wallet that exists out there, and I can access it if I just know what relay it's living on and the recovery phrase. And if I can get the code to run somewhere, I'm back in business.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, no, I'm a big fan of the left side of the bell curve solutions. Like for multisig, the XOR trick is, I just think that's great. Mm-hmm. So, verifiable data is a huge deal. If you can just spread things around and then suck them up and check that they're correct and decrypt them, and you're in business. And you don't even need relays necessarily. Like you're talking about seed recovery, but that's sort of a way of finding that stuff that's on the relays. But you could also store backup files on a hard drive or you know, like print out your wallet. Yeah, anything can be a relay, you know.
Yeah, well, for me the intriguing thing is that there's hundreds if not thousands of relays out there, and I it's almost like my wallet could be like a very opportunistic organism and decide to live on multiple relays, redundant or move about. And the relay operators are not implicated in the data that I'm storing. And that's what's captured me is, as I was saying earlier, maybe I didn't finish my thought. You know, there's all the stuff about data portability and that. And all of a sudden now I see there's a way to do it on my terms. You know, I encrypt stuff, I put it on your relay. Well, if a government authority comes to you, like all you can say is, well, like, you know, build your own little client and find whatever you want for my relay. Don't bother me. You know, you want the data. It's all there. Just go get it. Like, don't give me a production order. It's there. Just take what you need. That's the idea is that, I've totally kind of where my mind is that the social contract for data protection is completely broken with the big platforms.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't trust them anymore. I don't trust anybody anymore. Like practically I have to, but with all the breaches that are going on, it doesn't even make news anymore. And so my conclusion is that the social contract is broken. Governments can't do anything about it. The platform vendors basically just thumb their nose in your direction if it happens. And it's like, okay, that's it. I want to build something where all the security is 100% invested in that private key, period.
Yeah, end user license agreements just do not do the trick, especially since the user is the only one who has to sign them. The company doesn't have to sign anything that the user presents to the company.
Yeah.
And even if they did, it's all unenforceable anyway. So yeah, using technical solutions to bridge that gap makes a lot of sense. Kind of zooming out a little bit here. Like, what's your vision for what Nostr can do to like the world and society? What motivates you to do all this stuff? You know, is it just a hobby? Is this like a legacy project? What are you hoping that Nostr as a whole can kind of achieve?
Maybe it's a bit more of an obsession. It feels like 1993, before the internet went really big. You know, Tim Berners-Lee kind of figured out like HTTP and the web and that. And then a few years later, that new model totally disrupted the client server market back in the later 90s. And then the web revolution and like the .com revolution in like the early 2000s or so. The financial payment system is ripe for like total disruption. And I'm seeing that, you know, some might view Nostr as a toy, Zaps as a fun thing, but I'm looking at this and saying, wow, this is like the TCP/IP of finance here. Like TCP/IP is not the greatest protocol, but that's finally what got adopted. And, you know, the old saying goes, the internet used to run over the phone lines and now the phone lines run over the internet. So I think that's what's going to happen here is that if we do this right, we're going to have this open payment protocol. And I love the simplicity where every event can become a payment address. And that was the thing I realized with like my SafeFox is a command line, and I'm implementing everything as a command line with parameters. And it's just the fact that I can just say SafeFox zap 21 sats to this note, or SafeFox zap to this NIP5 address. And then it just, my logic just looks up the NPUB and does everything. It's like, oh, wow. Everything becomes not only like someone that can actually publish content, but I actually can send and receive payment. And so like the vision that I have is that now we have a true cyberspace address space that's been simplified, a 32 byte hex address for sake of argument, which can reflect a hash, a public key, whatever. We simplified that. So anything that can be a 32 byte addressable space, of course you need to know whether it's an event or a public key or whatever. And it's basically, you can build like a whole socioeconomic layer on that. And, kind of like in the early days of the internet, like, everybody was saying, oh, the internet's cool, but look at my intranet. I have an even cooler intranet, and look what it does. I have a portal page internally, and I have this and that. It's all behind a firewall or whatever. Well, and then today, nobody talks about that.
That's a super good point, yeah.
Yeah, and so what happened was that the internet, the protocol, basically, you don't even talk about firewalls or anything like that. You just, even though all that stuff happens underneath, like the network address, it's all endemic in the protocol. You don't even care about it. Well, the same thing's going to happen with currency as well. You know, the conclusion I've come to is that it'll be a long march, but and a few currencies will probably stick around, like the US dollar and maybe the Canadian dollar and from Canada and the euro maybe. But all those other currencies are just going to disappear. And the financial payment systems are predicated on like kind of this old intranet technology with clunky conversions and exchanges. And that was the big insight that I had with my payment system that I built and field testing it, was that people don't actually care about the technology underneath. They just want to get paid in their local currency. And oh, by the way, like in Madeira, like what they've done is that the merchants, they set up with like a point of sale terminal, and then they decide whether they want to keep it in Bitcoin or cash it out immediately or whatever. But when I go to a coffee shop or whatever, you want to get paid in euros? Okay, euros. And that and everything's calculated independently. They get the verification. And it's like, and then when I went back to Canada, I switched my wallet back to Canadian dollar. And there we go. And so it's going to be a long march, but the whole system will convert over to like a neutral payment mechanism. And it's, you know, maybe I'm being dramatic here, but you won't need Swift. You won't need any of these payment systems anymore. And like, I've been stress testing my system. Like, you know, I have skin in the game. I actually, you probably know the one artist on Nostra, Isolabel Art, that has really nice art.
Yeah.
Of course. So I bought a piece of art from him, like about 400 Canadian. And I did it all through SafeBox. I tested it. So it's like, okay, now I'm getting up there and I'm doing payments in the hundreds of dollars. And I've done Zaps, testing it out. Zaps, I was paying it to myself, but I was routing it through like Wallet of Satoshi and GitLB and different stuff. I was routing it through three independent systems. And I one of my events, I basically did $1,000. Like I did, I think four times 250K sats, so I had to go through. And I basically watched it. I did the zap, and about 10 seconds later, it came back in my wallet through like three surface systems. It's like,
oh. That is super cool. Very, very satisfying. Especially like seeing your own code do that too.
Yeah, so this really works. So, I guess I have this neat perspective that, you know, I've done a lot of strategic policy work and strategy like work in my management consulting days and my other days and that. And a lot of that stuff now, when I see what the highfalutin consultants do, it's just all PowerPoint stuff. You know, it's hilarious reading. Like I every once in a while, I'll take a look at what the Bank of International Settlements is doing and what the ECB is doing. Like, I try to read their papers. Usually they're too florid to understand them. And it's like, they have no clue what's coming. You know, and then if someone says, well, you know, it's like, I'd say, well, I built the system. It works.
Yeah.
So, no, I'm really, really, really excited for, like, the potential, like, yeah, for sure. My SafeBox is a little more than a proof of concept, and the code is crap and it has to be refactored, but it works. Or I feel like, you know, the Wright brothers on Kitty Hawk, like dangerous as hell on the plane. And, it only goes a couple hundred yards, but they got up in the air. And I just, feel the same way with this. So I just see a whole new frontier.
Yeah, that's that sums Nostra up pretty well. That's kind of where we're at, but I think we can bring all this stuff to maturity given a little bit of time. So
yep. Yeah, and I don't think we need to rush it. I know there's a lot of angst with Blue Sky, like getting like 20 million users or getting like 11 users per second or whatever. That's fine. I think what's going to happen is you're starting to see it. They're going to run the same problems with Twitter. And people would be dissatisfied. And of course, the missing piece is the payments piece. So I don't think social media is going to be the killer use case for Nostra. It will be like addressable payment addresses that you get by default. And I think that's an area that has yet to be explored. We're exploring it for sure within the context of doing like tips within social media, but I think you can build like a full-blown payment system that just uses Nostra as the fabric.
So we got a other stuff maximalist in the house, huh?
Yeah, and it didn't come because of an ideological bent. It came despite actually implementing the stuff and understanding it and realizing the implications and thinking about it. And I'm more committed than ever.
That's great. Cool. Well, thanks, Tim. That's a good place to leave it. I appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Super. Okay. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Good luck with Safebox and everything. It's a great project.
Okay. Take care. Okay. Bye.